time for Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. My name's the V-Man. I'll be your host on today's program. We're going to be discussing the latest news coming out of the Israel-Palestine region. The news being, of course, that the Israeli military is alleged to be withdrawing troops from the occupied lands of the Palestinians. Joining me on the phone tonight will be Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts and author of the book Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. Stand by, stay tuned, that's coming up next on Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Stay tuned. A July 1st New York Times article written by James Bennett begins, "Appearing side by side before meeting this evening, the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers declared mutual respect and expressed hopes for peace, while Israeli forces prepared to withdraw Wednesday from the West Bank town of Bethlehem. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of Israel said he envisioned a joint, quote, future of hope and prospects, which seemed to be, perhaps now more than ever, within reach," end quote. His Palestinian counterpart, Mahmoud Abbas, said it was time to, quote, put the past behind us, end quote. And Abbas declared, quote, "Each life that is lost is a human tragedy. No more suffering, no more death, no more pain," end quote. The article continues, but here tonight on Rockin' the Boat, we'll be discussing the latest developments in this dispute and hash out the prospects for peace. Joining me on the telephone is Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He is the author of 9 books, including The Obstruction of Peace, The U.S., Israel, and the Palestinians, Revising Culture, Reinventing Peace, The Influence of Edward Said, and his latest book is titled Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. In addition to these works, Professor Arouri has written numerous articles and book chapters. He contributes regularly to publications like Middle East International, Al Hayat, and other Arab dailies and weeklies. Nasir Arouri is a former member of the boards of Amnesty International USA and Human Rights Watch Middle East, and he is the current president of the board of TARI, the Trans-Arab Research Institute, a nonprofit educational organization which aims to provide focused research and public venues to analyze, discuss, and present perspectives on solutions to the problems in the Middle East. Professor Nasir Arouri, it's great to have you with us tonight on the program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, as I stated in the opening, recent media reports are painting a glowing picture of the situation in the Middle East right now. In the U.S., we hear reports that Israeli forces have begun dismantling outposts, that Hamas, Fatah, and the Islamic Jihad have declared a ceasefire, and that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas have mutual respect and are working together for peace and a peaceful solution to this conflict. Are Americans getting the whole story, or should we be somewhat skeptical of these reports we're hearing?
Well, I think that we should be inquiring as to what is it this time that might improve the chances for peace, particularly when we look back from 1969. The United States had proposed no less than 8 peace plans, and none of which has really worked out. And so there is an important question to ask here, and that is, why did all these peace plans fail? What is so different now that should make us more optimistic about the future as we look at this so-called roadmap to peace? So I think that we really need to be asking a lot of questions, because not everything is coming out, particularly in the mainstream media.
Well, maybe let's talk a little bit about one of the more recent peace plans, the Oslo Accords. Maybe if you could just give our listeners a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of what was put forth in Oslo and some of the similarities that you see between the current roadmap and the Oslo agreements.
Well, you know, actually, on the face of it, there seems to be quite a few improvements in the roadmap over Oslo. Here's a brief description of Oslo. You know, Oslo, the impetus behind Oslo, I think, was the Palestinian uprising called the Intifada, which started in 1987, and it was dwindling in the early 1990s. I think that the Intifada showed really fatigue in both camps. It did, I think, inflict some damage on the Israelis. It was a form of non-violent revolt whereby people wanted not only to show that the occupation was undesirable, but they wanted to show that it was impractical as well. And they were trying to defeat it administratively, trying to basically set up a system to replace the occupation. Well, there were actually circumstances in the region following the Gulf War, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and so on, that somehow, you know, inflicted really damage on the PLO, and the PLO was looking for a deal. So there you go. I mean, it was Oslo that was signed by a handful of people on both sides in secret in Oslo. And the Oslo agreement was not an agreement exactly. I think it was an agreement to reach agreement. What the two parties decided in Oslo is to defer the most intractable, problematic issues, to defer them and put them under a category which they called final status issues, and they were left for final status talks. Meanwhile, they spent about 7 years addressing the modalities for Israeli redeployment of forces. I don't call it withdrawal, but redeployment, and trying also to set up a self-governing institution for the Palestinians. Well, we all know what happened in the year 2000 when they met at Camp David and there was a fiasco. And there are really stories about that. I mean, the Israeli story is that they gave Arafat a generous offer, and he turned it down. Therefore, the Palestinians were not really interested in peace. I think that was really wrong, because the generous offer might have been, you know, the most generous that Israel had offered, but it did not certainly mean that it met the minimum conditions of international law and Palestinian aspirations. In fact, there was no 95% of the West Bank being returned to the Palestinians. In fact, I think at best it would have been about 65% of enclaves that were non-contiguous. So Oslo collapsed, because I think there were really structural flaws of Oslo. I want to mention here and emphasize that the terms such as occupation, which are really crucial, and withdrawal never appeared in Oslo. None of these words were there. But if you look at the roadmap today, you really do find that there is occupation, and it talks about ending the conflict, ending the occupation. It talks about withdrawal. And also, unlike Oslo, the roadmap says that the object would be, I mean, the end result should be a Palestinian state, an independent Palestinian state. Well, having said all this, then I should really be optimistic. And yet, I am skeptical about the roadmap for various reasons that we can perhaps talk about. So, but I should pause here and wait to see if you have any other specific questions. But I think that, you know, we could talk about the roadmap in more specific terms if you'd like.
I would. In fact, maybe it might be a bit instructive for some of our listeners to maybe get a bit of a historical perspective here. You wrote in an essay entitled, "Will Israel Ever Atone? Will the Palestinians Gain Restitution?" You write, and you begin by stating, the fact that Israel was born in the sin of dispossession of another people has never been seriously laid out for public discussion in the West. Maybe you can just lay out exactly how the state of Israel was founded and maybe why you think it is that there hasn't been this serious discussion.
Well, I mean, the state of Israel was founded in 1948. It was, it owes its existence to a United Nations resolution that was adopted in November 1947. And that resolution actually divided Palestine, historic Palestine, which is now completely controlled by Israel. It divided it into an Arab state and a Jewish state. The Jewish state was allotted a bit more than 55% of the land, and the Palestinian Arab state had just below 45% of the land. This was at a time, actually, that the Palestinians were two-thirds of the population, owning and using more than 93.5% of the land. So it did not really work out. I mean, the Zionists say that they were invaded by the Arab government, but in fact what happened is that there was a great deal of ethnic cleansing that the Zionist militias that later became the Israeli army have committed against a civilian population, and the Palestinian refugee problem was created, in fact, during the winter and spring of 1948, before the establishment of Israel, and while Britain was still responsible for law and order in Palestine. So the Palestinian state was never established, and the Israeli state was established in 1948 in more than 78% of Palestine. The remainder, which was 22%, was annexed by Jordan, and it became the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Now, in 1967, Israel occupied the rest of Palestine. Today, when you look at most of these plans, in fact, if we do review the peace plans from 1967 to the present, first of all, you find that every single one of them was sponsored by the United States, and every single one of them actually failed. So these plans were based on the assumption that the problem began in 1967. The article that you referred to about atonement, which I wrote a few years ago, it says that the problem really began in 1948 and not in 1967. And yet what we are seeing here is that most of these plans are based on the notion that the problem really began in 1967. However, when we look at the roadmap, which is what we have on the table now, the roadmap makes one think perhaps that the problem that we are remedying now is a problem that began not in 1948, not in 1967, but in the year 2000, because we're talking about possible withdrawal to the lines of 2000. In other words, when the talks of Camp David collapsed and when Sharon reoccupied the territory that was administered by the Palestine Authority. When they talk about dismantling illegal settlement, they really are not talking about the settlements which began in 1967 and before 1967. They are talking about the settlements that were established during the past 2 years and few months. I should say here that many of these settlements were established when Sharon, before he became prime minister, a few months before he became prime minister, was urging people to go to hilltops and to grab these hilltops and to set up, you know, whatever they can set up there. And indeed, in 2.5 years, they were able to set up somewhere between 180 to 200 settlements just in the past 2.5 years. It doesn't really do much good to dismantle those settlements and to leave the other settlements that have been that have become a thriving metropolis and that cuts right through Palestinian territory, cutting it to you know, fragments and so on. And you do have about 400,000 settlers, many of whom you know, began to live in the area some 35 years ago. What I was saying, and really in that article, is that if we want to see a credible peace, a peace such as the one that took place in South Africa with the end of the apartheid regime, then we really need to go to basics, and we need to raise the painful questions about the nature of the State of Israel and the circumstances in which it was created, and the injustice that was created in 1948, because I think other than that, we will be dealing with conflict management rather than reconciliation that could lead and should lead to a historic compromise.
I'm speaking with Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts. He's joining me here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is Rockin' the Boat. Each weekday from 5:30 to 6 o'clock, Professor Arouri. There's so many questions, and we're already short on time. So let's get to the U.S. role in this conflict. What do you believe is the motivation behind the U.S. As we know, sending upwards of $5 billion in military aid each year to Israel. Many of our listeners are familiar with that, but maybe you can give us your thoughts on. Why it is that the U.S., what do you think? Does the U.S. have like a moral or more of a strategic stake in the region?
Yeah, well, actually, that is really a minimum figure, the $5 billion, because there are other hidden costs, such as, you know, tax-exempt funds and things like that. But be that as it may, you asked me to explain what is really behind this. You know, the major issue here, I think, is really strategic. If one looks at the historical record, you find that the United States began to view Israel as a country with which it should have a special relationship. And that began with Nixon. I mean, of all people, Richard Nixon, who was considered, I think, by some, if not many, as anti-Semite. And yet, Richard Nixon, I think, is the first U.S. president who made a commitment to Israel that made a real difference in the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. In 1969, he pledged to guarantee Israel a margin of technological and military superiority over all her Arab neighbors combined. And that commitment was respected by every subsequent president. Why did he do that? He did that because he was looking at Israel as an attack dog, as, you know, here we failed in Vietnam miserably. General Tu and Marshal Key were our henchmen there. They failed miserably, and yet look at Moshe Dayan in 1967. He was able to defeat all these Arab governments in but 6 days, and that's why they call it the Six-Day War. And so there was something called the Nixon Doctrine, you know, whereby the United States said, we will supply the hose and they will supply the hose and water, and they will supply in Vietnam the firemen. Well, I guess the same thing was to be applied to Israel. In other words, we will supply the hose and water, meaning the money and the equipment and the military, etc. And the Israelis will supply the men. And therefore, they will hold things in check for us in the area. They will keep things under control. They will contain Arab nationalism. After all, they did defeat Nasser when Nasser was a rising, towering figure in the Arab world, trying to unify it, trying to create a new situation in the Middle East that was somehow deemed inimical to U.S. strategic interests and to Israeli interests. So it began there. By the time Reagan became president, Reagan described Israel as a unique strategic asset, and he promoted it, actually, from having a special relationship with the United States to a strategic alliance. And so the strategic alliance dates back to 1981, and from then on, things have really grown to the extent now that under George W. Bush, he sees Israel as being in the same trench in what he calls the war against terrorism. It was no secret and no accident that Israelis were among the foremost champions of, war in Iraq. They were urging the United States to go against Iraq because they viewed Iraq as a state with resources and potential. And if you smash the capability of Iraq, then you can intimidate Syria and the others, and that would really help Israel evolve into an unrivaled power. It is already a superpower regionally, but in any case, I think that now Israel is very much part of what George W. calls his war against terrorism. So there's been an evolution here from the Nixon period all the way to the present, where Israel is really seen as a cornerstone, as a linchpin, as an attack dog, if you will.
Mm-hmm. As you're stating, the U.S. is definitely attempting to redraw the map in the Middle East, as we can point to the war on terror in Afghanistan and now the occupation of Iraq, and coupled with this maneuvering in the Israel-Palestinian conflict, definitely we can see that's exactly what the U.S. is attempting to do. I'm speaking with Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts and author of the book Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine. We have about 6 minutes left, and I'd definitely like to wrap up on what you think the future holds. But I have one other question, and maybe you can address, and that is the right of refugees to return to their homes, and that has been upheld by international law and UN resolutions. But I'm wondering if you think that is the path towards reconciliation, that being the Palestinian right to return to places they were exiled from. What kind of country would they have if they were to return?
Well, I think that question of refugees has been also designated such as it was in Oslo. It has been designated as a final status issue, and therefore it is being deferred. I should mention here that when Israel accepted the roadmap in principle, Israel's cabinet outlined 14 reservations, 14 amendments to the roadmap, which President Bush promised to look at seriously, and he indicated to them, to the Israelis, that he does take them seriously. One of these 14 amendments has to do with the refugees, whereby Israel says that in order to even discuss the roadmap, they want the Palestinians to renounce the right of return. Now, this is a new one, actually. I think in the past, Israel tried to finesse the right of return, tried to obfuscate it, tried to postpone it, and so on. But now, they are saying that it's a precondition to even proceeding with the roadmap. That is a non-starter because, I mean, the right of the refugees to return is not just a collective right, but it is also an individual right. It is protected, as you mentioned, by international law, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I think is cherished by people around the globe, says that people have the right to leave their country and to return to their country. Well, this is their country. I mean, Israel now is the country from which these refugees fled and were expelled and ethnic cleansed. While Prime Minister Abbas, who had been designated to lead the Palestinians in the negotiations by Israel and the United States, I think they see him as more malleable than Arafat and probably any other leader, he is expected, I think, by the U.S. and Israel to do away with the right of return. But I think that this would be enough really to torpedo whatever talks and negotiations that go on. I doubt very much that making arrangements for the Palestinian refugees, who are about 5 million today, to return to 42% of the West Bank, and that is really what Sharon would offer the Palestinians at best, 42% of the West Bank. That is not going to work out. Let me just remind your listeners again that the West Bank is 22% of historic Palestine, and 42% of the 22% gives us something a little bit under 10% of historic Palestine, where these people used to be the overwhelming majority. So the stipulation that they go back to the Palestinian state is not going to do it. I mean, that state is going to be provisional, and that state is going to be to look very much like the statelets, like the Bantustans of South Africa, because any look at the map will show you that it is really non-contiguous territory. So it just would not work out.
In our final minute and a half that we have, maybe you can give us your vision of what is going to bring about a true and lasting peace, not only in the Middle East, but the world overall?
Well, I think that that in this issue here, I'm afraid that the two-state solution has long gone. I mean, I think that that it is too late for two states because you can't construct a Palestinian state, as I have been saying. My hope is that in the future there will be a common struggle, political struggle, by Israelis and Palestinians together, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, to establish a unitary state, a single state in all of Palestine, which is called Israel today, where they would respect the principle of one man, one vote, where there are no unreasonable classifications under the law, where you might have an application of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I mean, that you can't really have any unreasonable classifications and equality under the law, a secular state. I think that really this would probably be the only solution, but it's a long-term solution. But it's the only alternative, I think, to a perpetual conflict.
I've been speaking today with Nasir Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts and author of the book Dishonest Broker, The U.S. Role in Israel and Palestine, that just came out on Southend Press. And you can get that at your local bookstore. Nasir Arouri, I really appreciate your time tonight. Thanks for joining me on Rockin' the Boat.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
And join me tomorrow for another edition of Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. My guests tomorrow night will be discussing more on this, the Israel-Palestine conflict. I'll be speaking with the parents of murdered ISM activist Rachel Corey. Craig and Cindy Corey will be joining me live tomorrow night on Rockin' the Boat. Tune in then, 5:30 to 6 o'clock right here, 96.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. Thanks for listening. Good night.